Chapter 1. The hissing of pistons, the whine of servos. Armor-shod feet rhythmically stomping, weighed down by the brute power of a railgun. All of these were things he enjoyed. The Buckmaster, a marvel of engineering, is the only scout mech chassis able to mount such a heavy weapon. He thought the Buckmaster deserved a better name, so he called it what it truly was, a hunter. Specialist Hugh Armbruster loved his mech. Sector 78, Perimeter Patrol, call sign Hunter, 20:52 hours. Armbruster's body swayed gently in time with the machine's loping gait, safely cocooned in the darkened cockpit. Perfectly in tune with his steel Hunter, he surveyed from 20 feet up, silently begging for a reason to unleash hell. His faith in both his skills and equipment were unbreakable. The smells of grease and gun oil, the only things he'd been able to identify clearly for some years now, told him he was home. The only trouble was, after 10 years of loyal service, there were still no wars to fight. He viewed the world through a series of vision blocks and several monitors, showing the washed-out feed from cameras mounted upon the pitted hull, carrying out standard checks with monotonous regularity. Armbruster's eyes flicked across to view his left flank and, as always, all he could see was mold-strewn concrete. The perimeter wall, vast and imposing, the 100-foot-high sheer surface was an ever-present reminder to the citizens of Solo Nobre that Great Leader was there, and he was looking after them. To his right, the light mech was just coming up on the edge of the habitat area for Sector 78. He could already see off-duty shift workers milling about outside several dingy bars, smoking and chatting amongst themselves. Being the furthest outpost of District 4, Sector 78 was a dead end, in more ways than one. Once a primary logistics hub, responsible for shipping vast quantities of supplies to and from the other capital cities, it possessed a large rail depot within its confines. The military put an end to that after the Troubles, vowing to make every capital self-sufficient, a fortress against attack from an outside foe. All the outer gates but one were welded shut, and units were posted to each and every sector, with no exceptions. Great Leader was determined not to make the same mistakes as his late progenitor. The former rail depot now stood unused, its engines and carriages rusting onto their tracks, reducing Sector 78 to several square miles of mostly wasteland. The inhabitants were overspill from other sectors. This new generation lived atop the bones of their forebearers, too exhausted to care about their plight after a 13-hour shift down the mines. It was these people that Armbruster viewed through his hazy cam feed. Hard-faced young men and women, lean of frame, the deep red dust of the mines etched into their clothes and skin, aging them beyond their years. Heads turned practically as one at the sound of the mech's approach, faces displaying the uniform scowl of disenfranchised youth. Armbruster zoomed in and had to laugh at the weird facial tattoos and hairstyles that these people sported, despite their hard-working life. How strange these people were. He looked at his watch, then brought the Hunter to a halt. Hunter 2, this is 1. Hold here, the pilot said over the squad radio net. Hunter 2, Roger, was the clipped response from his wingman, Specialist Chris Almeida. Releasing the right joystick for the first time in what felt like hours, Armbruster flexed his knuckles painfully before reaching up to his right and flicking a switch on the comm panel. Feedback buzzed from the cerebral jack. It always felt like a slight pull on the socket, like some phantom was gently teasing the cable out as his own mental faculties took up the slack from reduced manual input. His mind kept the unstable war machine balanced as external speakers crackled loudly, and he cleared his throat. "Citizens of Sector 78, he said, voice projected so it could be heard for 1,000 yards in all directions. Please disperse. Curfew will be in effect in 7 minutes. Curt and precise, Armbruster was happy with his delivery, then decided to add, "You may require the time to walk home." Indeed, the sun had already dipped below the wall line, casting a sickly yellow light over scattered clouds. The civilian's collective scowl intensified and they started drinking their sundry concoctions ever so slightly faster before returning to previous conversations. It was Arm Brewster's turn to frown. He had never appreciated disobedience. It stank of a lack of discipline, so he drove both joysticks forward and flipped the thumb safety of his secondary weapon. The scout mech lurched towards the bar patrons, machine gun bolts clunking loudly as powered ammo feeds drove an 8mm FMJ round into the chamber. It had the desired effect. The civilians dispersed, picking up coats and other assorted personal items before briskly walking deeper into the slums. Several threw hateful looks over their shoulder as they went, but Arm Brewster didn't care as long as they did what they were told. "They don't usually do that," Almeida observed from his own mech a couple hundred yards away. "No," replied Arm Brewster, watching the last of the civilians disappear down a side alley. "They do not." Captain Edwina Blake was uncharacteristically nervous. Nothing usually rocked steady Ed, not on the surface at least, and today had been no exception until now. The morale tour had gone smoothly. All egg units had been clean and well presented, functioning well within acceptable parameters for the inspection. Senior Sergeant Kronig had worked wonders, being seemingly everywhere at once during the preparation phase, cannibalizing old junkers and wrecks to get the maximum amount of legs online. It had been hard on everyone. The usual patrol matrix had to be maintained, as well as an active quick reaction force, the members of which grumbled the loudest upon being informed of the inspection. But it had to be done. You don't let your guard down when the hero of Solo Nobre comes to say hello. Colonel Charles Rome looked immaculate and invincible as always. He'd grown a few grey hairs and gained a few laughter lines since Blake had known him at the academy, but not even the neat shrapnel scar diagonally bisecting his chin could diminish his charm. She hadn't seen him in the years since the food riots, and couldn't help but wonder if he'd let the fame go to his head. Those thoughts had been quashed soon after he arrived. He immediately ignored the prescribed tour schedule and went to see the troops first. Blake thought him acting the shrewd politician, cultivating his immense popularity with the conscripted forces. It was an obvious play. Nobody likes standing to attention for hours, waiting on senior officers. Then she saw him in action and changed her mind on the spot. On the immaculate garage floor, Rome returned a crisp salute to Senior Sergeant Kronig before cracking a smile and telling the troops to relax. A moment of uncertainty was followed by a collective sigh of relief, and Edwina felt days of tension disappear from the base. He engaged the men with easy banter, not in the forced, awkward way that made her usually avoid such interactions. "Your boots fit okay. Mail getting through, hmm? Very good." There was none of that where Rome was concerned. He cracked jokes, taking the thinly veiled jibes that characterized enlisted soldiers the globe over and fired back with a razor wit. Pulling no punches, he instantly crossed the carefully constructed barrier between officers and enlisted and became one of them. She quietly observed this easy back and forth, the effortless rapport that Rome established with her fighters, and she just could not resent him for it, despite the obvious reasons. So what if it advanced faster than her? So what if it was a case of right place, right time? Blake had often wondered if she would have reacted differently if she were present during the riots, but it didn't matter. She saw why Rome had been picked up as a symbol and a hero while he was talking to her men, even putting them at ease while he inspected the slowly decaying equipment. "It's not your fault," he said. "You're doing the best you can with what you've been given." She could tell he really meant it. None of that was responsible for making her nervous now. The inspection had been a resounding success, and indeed the morale tour had achieved the desired effect for once. It was that Colonel Charles Rome had requested to speak with her in private, with that trademark glint twinkling in his eye. Ed Blake threw water on her face and reached for a towel. She rubbed vigorously, getting the grime out of her pores that always accumulated after any time spent around mechs. Peering into the mirror, a heart-shaped face toned by years of physical training looked back. Tanned skin and coal-black eyes were now streaked by worry lines that betrayed her carefully maintained image of an emotionless rock. What the hell does he want to talk about? We'd already reminisced over the good old days. The colonel had reminded her that she had scored considerably higher than him at the academy, to which she'd retorted how ironic it was the brass deemed her the epitome of officer standards. It was a conversation they'd had before, and about as far as things went in terms of common ground. So it isn't a chinwag he wants. Hanging the towel back on its railing, she glanced up once more to fix her composure, taking a breath and picking at a non-existent loose thread. Dark eyes and black hair, shot through with streaks of grey, were characteristic of the original settlers of Novo Solo, and assembled themselves on her face in a manner that she would describe as nondescript. Despite this, she had never been short of potential suitors of either sex, most of which she had rebuffed. There were no rules against relationships with colleagues in the Great Leader's military, but after several fumbling attempts early on in life, Blake had genuinely lost interest in romantic pursuits and concentrated on her career. And how gleaming that had become. Commander of Outpost 78, last bastion at the edge of the city, manned by the heroic forces of the Novo Exercito de Povo, or New People's Army in the modern tongue. Here, they patrolled the outer border of the city against the non-existent threat from outside, while simultaneously staying apart from the occasional outbursts of civil unrest witnessed deeper within the districts. It was, quite possibly, the most boring posting available in the whole city. The civilians of Sector 78 didn't even get involved in the food riots that engulfed most of Solo Nobre 6 years previously. The sector seemed lost in time, as if stuck in that exhausted first year after the troubles ended, its population giving a collective shrug of indifference to outside events. It seemed to Blake that the world was equally indifferent to her. She held no jealousy for Rome. If anything, she was proud of the figurehead he'd become. The city needed more soldiers like him in command positions, countering that bitter weight of the old guard. But given the stark contrast between her and Rome's career trajectories, she wondered if he and the rest saw her as utterly mediocre, just a by-the-numbers captain who never caused trouble and safely landed in a dead-end assignment. Gathering her hair into a tight ponytail and exiting her quarters, she agreed with that assessment. Private Reynolf Kinney was pissed off. "No, stand down," the sergeant said. "Not while the colonel is still in the base." He didn't understand it. They only had 3 hours until rotation to QRF, and he wanted a couple hours of shut-eye before ready-up. He looked across the garage floor at his power suit, a Mongoose M841, or MOG, and hated it with irrational venom. Its canopy was open, which was just a single piece of curved armour raised on hydraulic rams, showing off the assault harness underneath. Twin 8mm machine guns were raised on the MOG's arms, pointing to the ceiling in the stowed or safe position. The whole machine had a fresh coat of olive drab paint on it, but even that couldn't hide the age of the thing. Adapted from an older design that the first colonists brought with them, the Mongoose was a bastard of a machine. Those colonists used to strip them down to bare minimum functionality so they could be mass-produced with the limited resources at their disposal. The Troubles put an end to that, however. Now they were stuck with rust buckets, forced to constantly cannibalise what they had left and repair their ageing arsenal, all to maintain the military's precarious position of power over the populace. Kinney used to think it made him special when he got pulled from infantry training for MOG school. He scored damn well in the tests too. His cerebellum was sufficiently attuned to accept a cranial jack, and that meant he got to stride into the battlefield in his own 8-foot-tall death machine. Except, there weren't any battlefields anymore. His Mongoose power suit was a relic from the last conflict, adapted from a war machine to a utility vehicle and back again. He constantly got bad feedback, ghost images on his cam display, and the left leg twitched with annoying frequency. So much so that he swore the M841 was a living being, one that was trying to kill him. Sometimes it simply refused to respond to any commands at all. Sergeant Kronik had informed him that it was just teething problems. It would be okay after a few months of bedding in. "Mugs are a bit temperamental when breaking in a new driver," he'd assured him. After 7 months into a year-long tour of routine patrols and Sergeant Kronik, the novelty of being a Mongoose pilot had worn off. Plus, the sergeant's mentality right now didn't make any sense. The colonel himself had told them all to relax. Else, even the so-called hero of the riots had turned out to be a legend. The colonel was nothing like Steady Ed Blake, the most boring, uninspiring ice bitch he'd ever met in his 19 years of life. That guy Rome had a way with words, and Kinney had felt empowered by them. He nearly bought into his smooth BS before giving himself a reality check. "Ulf, what are you thinking there, little brother?" The voice belonged to Private Stephen Bader, Kinney's battle buddy and best friend in the unit. It wasn't his real brother, but they had bummed around together since they were kids and were rarely apart. "Because by the look on your face, I'd say you're about ready to re-up." He capped the comment with a big shit-eating grin. Bader was a year ahead of Kinney, and his compulsory service contract was up at the end of the tour. Then he'd be off to join Kinney's actual older brother Carlos, and all their other friends with the Corvids. Kinney looked up to him, not just because he was friends with Carlos, but because he looked out for him out of genuine respect. "Shut up, man, just because you're short." "I heard you're having second thoughts yourself," Kinney retorted, his heart not in it. "Nope, I'm as good as gone, little man. You watch. I'll come visit you next year, and you'll be like him." Bader gestured across the garage to where Sergeant Jack Kronig was tinkering inside his power suit. "Invoking the saints every time a piston head cracks in your power plant." Kinney laughed. "Seven hells no. Promise you'll kill me if I get like that." Bader ignored him, jumping into a pitch-perfect gravelly growl, impersonating the old Sarge. "By Martin's toolbox, I command you to find a firing solution. By Nara's duct tape, please hold this assembly together." Kinney chimed in and they both burst out sniggering. "Are you two questioning the holiness of St. Nara's duct tape?" Corporal Anna Mirante loomed behind them, a white-toothed smile plastered across her wide, blunt features. "No, Corporal," both privates chimed, and Anna chuckled. The big mog driver pulled over an ammo crate and sat down on it, resting muscular arms on the knees of her jacksuit. Mirante was a career soldier, a few years older than Kinney and Bader, and she had the classic mog driver's physique. She was tall, but lean and well-muscled from years of sitting in a hot cockpit, dealing with a constant exertion of willing the damn things to do what they were told. She was in a different squad to the two privates, but they got on like a house on fire. "So, what are my girls talking about, Ulf?" Kinney shrugged. He hated that nickname, but it stuck like a limpet mine ever since he made the mistake of exclaiming, "My name's Reynulf, not Ulf." "Nothing much, Anna. I just wanted to get a bit of head down before we ready up. That's all." Bader shot him a crooked look. "Don't sugarcoat it, Ulf," he said. "You're sick of that, idiot." He threw a thumb over his shoulder to where Kronig was deep in the guts of his machine. "We both are," he continued. "Why are we here? He keeps us hanging about for no reason. He knows we're on QRF in a few hours, but we're sitting here sweating in our jacksuits. For what?" Anna turned slightly red at the cheeks as she watched Kronig fuss over an accelerator linkage. He'd probably checked it a dozen times. "I know what you mean. I swear, if he makes me call him Sergeant one more time, I'm going to shoot him in the face next time we're on the ground. I'm an NCO too, for Eatem's sake." Although the tone was kept light, she stressed her words. Bader feigned surprise. "Corporal, did you just take a saint's name in vain? For shame! And I find your undermining of the chain of command quite disturbing. Expect my report on Kronig's desk." Bader flinched as Mirante gave him a solid right cross to the arm. "Dick," she said. Kinney laughed. "Ow! Let me finish," Bader went on, raising a finger with a wince. "I'll report you, right after he makes us do a bunch of stupid battle drills we'll never use, if I can still walk. And he'll probably hand-to-hand combat you for it." Kinney chimed in with the appropriate chopping motions. "Because that's essential stuff to know when driving a war machine." Another round of laughs. There was a natural pause in the conversation, and the trio found themselves looking at Kronig once more. "Look at him," Bader said. "He's one of the greatest generation, apparently." Kinney nodded absently. "Who even calls them that? Nobody. What has Kronig done with his life? Why should we respect him?" Kinney could have mentioned that he won the Distinguished Service Cross, whatever that was, but didn't want to contradict his friend. He had wondered many times how good Kronig could actually be, with the fact that he was in his 50s in an army that promoted on merit and still only an NCO. Their generation put that monster in power. And what has he done for us since? Bader was on a roll. The tone had got more serious immediately, and his voice dropped with it. Speaking out against the great leader was treason. Even now, it carried a death sentence. I'll tell you what, he's hamstrung our society with this autocracy of his. We can't build anything to better ourselves anymore. All we have is conscription or a life in the mines. A life in the army isn't so bad, Anna shrugged, reluctant to engage fully, being a career soldier herself. It's a living. No, it isn't, Bader bit back. It's an existence. It's just slightly better than the alternative. Kinney found himself transfixed on Bader as he spoke. This was the stuff that he lived for, and why he needed to be out of the army. These fools let themselves be led around like cattle. He pointed over at Kronig's Mog again. Practically slaves to the system until they've bled out for some state pension. And they'll have you believe we should be thankful for it. They grind us down with no incentive other than perpetuating the cycle, and then wonder why so many of us join the Corvids. Revolution, man, Kinney said quietly. That's what we need. Oh, don't start with this again, Anna said with a roll of the eyes. The Corvids are a joke. Nobody takes them seriously. That's because you're from Central. If you lived where we came from, out in the dead, you'd know. Bader nodded firmly in agreement with his friend. There are hundreds of thousands of them out there. You'll see. They'll tear this wreckage down and rebuild. Anna frowned. She didn't want to get drawn into this argument again. It would always devolve into a back and forth about the orbital guns and whether they actually did stop the corporations from taking over. Ulf's right, Bader said energetically. He was slipping into his comfortable routine, bringing up well-worn points they'd all heard before. When was the last time you saw a ship leave the city? Or heard of one leaving the planet at all, for that matter? He stared at Anna, who shrugged reluctantly. Never. Not in our lifetime, at least. You know why? The blockade, she said flatly. The blockade, Bader and Kinney parroted with enthusiasm. We can't go anywhere or do anything because of those stupid orbital guns. The rest of the galaxy is advancing out there, and here we are, trapped on our own world because our leaders are too arrogant to open a dialogue with the corporations. Anna shook her head. You know there were orbital guns before, right? Anna replied, her tone still conveying unwillingness to truly engage. Yeah, Bader bit back. There were about 1/10 of what we have now, and they were all way smaller in caliber. The old ones were just a deterrent. The hierarchy knew they didn't mean business. The old hierarchy knew that a comprehensive orbital gun grid would cripple the economy, Kinney chimed in. Anna was about to retort, but she stopped herself. She really couldn't be bothered tonight, and instead smiled. Tell you what, she said. When you rise up and overthrow us, I promise not to waste your piddly asses with my mug. How's that sound? Glances were shared. Then they all chuckled gently. That's a deal, Corporal, said Reynolf Kinney. When I'm in charge, I'll make you a general or something. Corporal Morante, Kronig rumbled. His voice seldom rose above a hate-filled growl. The trio jumped collectively. Kronig had just appeared from behind the M841. How long has he been there? Kinney thought with a jolt of alarm. Yes, Anna replied politely. Yes, what, Corporal? Anna's face flushed and her eyes flickered with rage for the shortest moment. Yes, Sergeant, she corrected herself through practically gritted teeth. Can I have a word, Corporal? In private. Yes, Sergeant, said Anna, her voice louder now, flat in tone. She rigidly stood up from her seated position and moved in the direction of the senior sergeant's office. Kronig remained and stared at the two young men. He was tall and broad, with a frame of solid muscle that only recently had begun to soften at the waist with age. Kronig's grey hair was high and tight, reminiscent of old regulations that no longer applied to today's army. The haircut revealed the black alloy plate that comprised a fair portion of his skull, curving round from the cranial jack to stop just behind his temple. His left arm twitched spasmodically. The joint servos were made of the same black alloy as the skull plate and gave little mechanical whimpers with his every movement. Every twitch was matched by a slight change in his expression. He was clearly in constant pain, and that only made him more difficult. Privates, the sergeant said softly. Kinney and Bader automatically stood to attention. Sergeant! They responded in unison. He glared at one of them for an awkward few seconds, then the other, boring into their skulls with his eyes. Kinney wondered how he still managed to appear more smartly presented than either he or Bader, despite his jacksuit being covered in oil. "If I hear either of you speaking of revolution again, I swear in Martim's name, I will fucking kill you." And with that, he turned to stalk after Corporal Morante. Kinney and Bader turned to each other, both wearing the same smirk. They sniggered like schoolboys